All right, we're beginning on the top of Gimel Amud Aleph. The Gemara begins with Lishna Achrina, which is another way to start the discussion regarding the explanation of our Mishnah. Yesterday we proposed that the word Mechitza in the Mishnah meant Guda, meant a wall. And then the Gemara gave an alternative in that discussion, which is maybe it means to split. Today's Gemara with the Lishna Achrina is going to start the other way, which is the proposal is going to be that it means to split. They're going to offer the other option, which is it's a wall, and come back to the conclusion that it means to split, which is the halacha. This is the way that we paskin. Even though the Lishna Achrina begins with Amrila Savrua, they thought to say, which again, as we mentioned yesterday, Savrua usually means that the Gemara is proposing something that will be rejected. But as the Rabbeinu Tam noted on the Daf Bet Amud Aleph, that here the Savrua is just copying the previous structure of the Gemara, but not telling you that this is not going to be the conclusion. So Surah Amay Mechitza. So they thought in the Mishnah, what is the meaning of Mechitza? Plukta, a division. Dichtiv. They bring the same pasuk that we brought yesterday, Vadi Mechitza Ta'ida. So here you see the word Mechitza, Mechitzat, used to describe a division rather than a physical wall that is there. Once they agree to the split, then we build the wall against their will. Alma, from this you would conclude, Hezekriah Shmei Hezek. That from this you would conclude that Hezekriah is a serious issue, because once you've concluded that you will split the area, you must put up a wall to prevent the problem of Hezekriah. So the Gemara says, Ve'ema Mai Mechitza Guda. So here the Gemara goes in the opposite direction and says, how do you know that Mechitza means to split? Let's say Mechitza means to literally put up a wall. Detanyo, Mechitza da keren she nifritza omer lo gidor. Nifritza omer lo gidor. Niteesh yemena velo gadra, is there a kidesh? V'chaya b'achriyuta, same braita that we brought yesterday from Kilayim. Where you see that Mechitza da keren is clearly speaking about a wall because the wall is falling down. And then you're warning him to fix it. If he gives up actually fixing it, then you have a problem of kilei hakerem, and he's responsible for the damage that's done. But the word mechitzat hakerem is used to describe a physical wall. V'taymo derotzu. It's only because they acquiesced that there is a wall. Halarotzu. They did not agree to put up a wall. Ein mechayvin oto. We don't compel them. Alma, chezegriah, lo shmei hezeg, that Hezek Riyah is not considered to be a Hezek in this case. Rashi says again here, V'chatzer she'esh ba'din chalukah. It's a chatzer that have the ability to be split. Since it has the ability to be split, any party can compel the other party to split the chatzer. Once you've split the chatzer, if they want, they can put up a wall. If they don't want to, they don't have to put up a wall. That shows you that the necessity for a blocking wall is not there. And that means, Hezekriah, lo shmei hezek, iachi, bonim et hakotel. The problem of the language that we saw in the Mishnah was that it says in the Mishnah, ha-shutafim shiratzu lasot mechitza. Now we're saying it means lasot kotel. Bechatzer, bonim et hakotel. You're repeating the word kotel twice. So that doesn't make so much sense. Iachi, bonim et hakotel, bonim oto, mibayla. You should have used the pronoun. Elamai. So what do you prefer? You prefer plukta, that it means to split? If that's the case, then the language is also difficult because it says in the Mishnah, Shiratzu lasot mechitza. Lasot mechitza would make sense if you're saying to make a wall, to build a wall. Lasot mechitza, to make a split, that's not the verbiage that you would have used. It should have just said they wanted to split it. They don't need the verb lasot there if you have the verb to split, which would have been a better verb to use rather than putting lasot mechitza. Kedamre inche, the Gemara says, no, that is a colloquialism. Ta navid plukta, let us go make a split. So there is such a language or verbiage that is used in their time, and therefore lasot mechitza is not so far-fetched. The Gemara did not bring this answer in the previous sequence, but over here the Gemara does give an answer to that problem, and therefore it stands in the end that Navid Plukta is not problematic in terms of the language of the Mishnah. Vi Hezek Riyah Shmei Hezek. If Shmei Hezek Riyah is really Hezek, Ma'iriyah Ratzu. Then what is the word Ratzu doing over here? Afilu lo Ratzu Nami. Even if they didn't want to do it. If hezekriah is a serious issue, then what is the want to split it, not want to split it? None of that is all relevant. We should compel them to put up a wall between them. Amar Rabasi, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mishnatenu, kishein ba din chaluka. This is something that we already discussed yesterday, that in the case of Plukta, Mechitza, you have to say the reason that it's Ratsu is because there is no compelling reason to split the Chatzer. The Chatzer is not a divisible area. As opposed to a Chatzer that contains four amot for each party, we'll see later on in Daf Yud Aleph, that means four amot for each party plus four amot each outside each door, then the chatzer is nitan l'chalukah, which means that it's of a size that makes sense to split it. In that instance, then you can compel the parties to put up a wall, or Hezek v'yesh me'ezek, you can do something about it. Here you're talking about a chatzer that is too small to split. The utility of the chatzer, in some ways, would be impaired if you split it, because there's only sufficient room for both of them to use it, but if you split it, then each one doesn't have sufficient room to do anything in. So there we're not going to compel them to split the chatzer. That's the nature of the chatzer. If they then decide, Ratzu, they want to split it, we will help them split at that point. But that's because it doesn't have a din chalukah. It doesn't have a din of splitting. Behu de Ratzu. That's only if they want to. My kamash malon. So what are you teaching us there? Dechileit be din chalukah. That when it doesn't have the sufficient or requisite space to be divided, kiratsu pligay, when they want to, we will split it. So now that's what it's teaching you. Tanina, that's an upcoming Mishnah. The Mishnah upcoming states that explicitly, which is ematai bisman she'en shnehem rotzim. When is that the case? When neither of them want to. Aval bisman she'shnehem rotzim afilu pachot mikan hochokim. So it's talking about a chatzer that is less than the requisite space to split. It says over there, you don't split it. When is that true? When neither of them want it. But when both of them want it, go ahead. We allow you to split it. So that's already giving us the information that you're getting out of our Mishnah, which is when you have a chatzer with less than the requisite space, you're allowed to split it. That's an explicit Mishnah. What do I need our Mishnah to tell us that? Ima ha'tam, from that upcoming Mishnah, Avamina, afilu pachot mikan b'misipas bi'alma, that even less than that, it would be sufficient with those stakes that go through the middle. You just put up a borderline between you. Kamash malon, from our Mishnah, hacha kotel. You see that you need literally a wall. Where it says, v'litnei ha, v'lo litnei hach. So then write our Mishnah, and don't write the subsequent Mishnah. Our Mishnah is giving you more information. It's telling you when it's not sufficiently large to split it, you're allowed to split it. And it's telling you when you do split it, you're going to have to put up a wall. That's all the information you need. Then why do you need the upcoming Mishnah to tell you, oh, when there isn't sufficient grounds to split it, if you agree, you can't split it. You don't need that information. We have it already from the first Mishnah, where it says, Seifa itzrichalei. You need that for the latter part of the Mishnah on Daf Yud Aleph, because it says, V'kitvei HaKodesh, afo pi sheshneihem rotzim, lo yachloku. When it comes to Kitvei HaKodesh, it's the last part of the Mishnah, even if both parties agree to split it, we don't split it. Over here, when we're talking about Kitvei HaKodesh, we're talking about any of the Sifrei Tanakh, but the Sifrei Tanakh that are written like a Sefer Torah, as Rashi writes, Begilyon. They're written in a way that is properly laid out, they are rolled onto rollers. These are properly written books of Tanakh. So over there, you can't decide between you. I'll take the first half of Yishayahu, and you take the second half of Yishayahu. Yishayahu Baalef and Yishayahu Bet. You can't do that. You're missing the transition in the Mishnah, which is the Mishnah talks about Chatzerot, and then it talks about other items there, and then it gets to Kitvei HaKodesh. So it says at the end of the Mishnah that Kitvei HaKodesh, even though both parties want, we don't split it. All right, now we're going to skip here the parentheses. You can see the parentheses go down to the two dots later on. Part of that is because the Gemara coming up is going to basically say exactly what is said in this previous Gemara. Plus, the truth is that the Gemara that we skipped over here is mentioned in the Tosfot, Divrei HaMatkil, Bekeven Deratzu, on Bet Amud Bet. Over there, the Ri has a question on the Gemara as to why the Mishnah is structured in a case that area does not have a din chaluka, Biratzu, that they wanted to split it. Lo litnei Ratzu, ula arish yesh ba din chaluka. Just skip the word Ratzu in the Mishnah, and then speak about a case where it is big enough to be split, and then it has nothing to do with Ratzu. And the answer is that the reason that the Tana of the Mishnah put in the word Ratzu and talked about an area that is Enu Din Chalukah was to come to dispel this notion that the agreement between them was simply to split the area, but not an agreement to build the wall or give up space to build the wall. And so Tosafot at the end there says, V'yesh svarim demakshim u'mataretz kein lehadja b'shili shmaitin. There are some Gemaras that have this question and answer explicitly in the Gemara. And that is actually found, besides the Gemara that we're about to read, which contains the other parts of this Gemara, that extra section in the piece that we're skipping is found in the Tosfot, Divrei HaMatkil, Kim Deratzu, on the previous Samud, and he says that some of the Svarim, some of the Gemaras actually have that embedded in the Gemara itself. So now the Gemara says, B'mai ukimta lematnitin. How did you now establish our Mishnah? B'she'en ba'din chaluka. It's a case where there was not sufficient ground or chatzer here to split. Yet, if they decide to split it together, they are allowed to split it, because that's what the ratzu is now. And then we said, once they decide to do it, they must put up a wall between them. That is, seemingly, in a case where one of them wants the wall. Again, if both of them don't want the wall, then you get into a bigger question about mechila with regards to hezek riya. And then you'd have to determine whether hezek riya is real nezek, and you can have mechila. Or is hezek riya an isur where there is no din of mechila? The Gemara says, v'i b'she'en ba'din chaluka, kiratsu mayhavi. Once you have established that this is not an area where you have a right to demand a split, and the only reason that there is a split here is because you came to an agreement of the parties, then what is the difference that you guys came to your agreement? Nahadrabu, let one of them walk away from the agreement. How is the agreement between them binding? All they have is a verbal agreement which says, yeah, okay, we can split the chatzer. How do you prevent the other party from walking away from that agreement? Now, once they've done that and they put up the wall, obviously they can't walk away from it because then there's something physical has been done to carry out the agreement. But at this point in time, all you have is a verbal agreement. How do you lock in a verbal agreement? So, Amar Rav Asi, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, shukanu miyadan, that they made a kinyan. Now, Rashi says over here that the kanu miyadam is a form of kinyan chalipin. They did a kinyan chalipin to lock in the agreement. The Gemara says, v'chikanu miyadam mayhavi. What does a kinyan chalipin do here? Kinyan dvarim ba'almahu. You are trying to make an agreement about an intangible item. A kinyan chalipin, the way that Rashi describes it is, ein chalipin konin al davar ha-nikneh. You can only use a kinyan chalipin to take something that is tangible or physical and exchange it for the kinyan chalipin. That's how it works. Over here, what is the figurative exchange that is happening for the kinyan chalipin? It's a handkerchief between you. There's nothing that's coming back in return. There's no physical object or physical item that is being exchanged for in the kinyan chalipin. And so Rashi says it works by mecher, matana, shibud karkaot, works by all of these items, but that's only if there is something that happens. Some of the Rishonim phrase it immediately. If something happens immediately, like there is a shibud of some sort that happens immediately, then that kinyan chalipin can work. But a kinyan chalipin can't work to commit people to a future demand on them or future obligation on them when the item here, there is no physical item that exchanges hands. So the Gemara here only asks this question on the Manda Amar that we're talking about a split, implying that the one who says that it's a kotel doesn't have this problem because they are going to get the materials. There's a physical item that's there and that's not a problem. So that's what the Baal Tosafot say over here. The Ikar LeMeimar, the Kanu v'Shibdu Nichseihem LeBinyan HaKotel. In addition, he says, Hatam Lav Kinyan Dvarim Hu'ala Kinyan Gamuru Shem Meshabedet Atzmam Shem Yaneis Yishaleh. So there is a commitment by the case of building the wall, or by the case of, here he gives a case of a Shomer Chinam, taking on the responsibilities of being a Shoel. Over there, there's a commitment that makes you Chayav, or extends your obligations immediately. So that's something that you can create a kinyan dvarim or kinyan chalipin for. Here, nothing changes at this moment. There's nothing here that is going to change. You're not giving up anything. You're not exchanging anything. And your commitment's only for the future, which is to say that we will split it. We will split it. Then has ramifications. Once you've decided to split it, then you must build a wall. That's not part of the original obligation. So how are you creating the commitment here? The Gemara is going to answer. B'shekanam yadan biruchot. So they decided to split it by determining which half of the chatzer belongs to each party. Meaning that you'll get the eastern side, I will get the western side. So now you've done something physical. You've actually split the chatzer. It's not an agreement to split the chatzer. We're actually physically splitting the chatzer. And so you pick the eastern side, I pick the western side, and then you do a kinyan. Now that you can do, because now you've created something tangible or differences on the ground that are actually visible now. So it's no longer just a verbal agreement, there's actually ramifications to the agreement. It doesn't have to be literally that there's a physical change, it just has to be there's a change in your obligations here, or your commitments here. When you say you're going to split it, nothing changed. When you say, I'm taking the eastern side, the western side, something now changed, because now you have actually one side of the chatzer is now yours versus the other side. Rashi Amar Kigon, Shalach Ze B'toch Shelo Ve'Gzik, Ve'Ze B'toch Shelo Ve'Gzik. So Ravashi says that we actually have a physical walking, a chazokah in the classic sense of Kinyan Karkaot. By Kinyan Karkaot, we know there are three ways to do it, Kesef, Shtar, and Chazokah. Chazokah is either to one of the forms of chazakah is nal gadar paratz, but walking the property or demarcating where your property is, that is something that is a full-fledged type of chazakah. Tosfot over here already asks, what's Rav Ashi doing? Rav Ashi is telling us a halacha psuka, halacha that's well known. What do you need Rav Ashi for to tell you that there is a din of chazakah when you do such a thing? It says, v'nir l'ri da'aka mashma, and he says that this is what it teaches you. We get there in Cheskat Batim that when you have a kinyan on karka shelo bifanav, then you have to have the other party say lech chazek uknei. He has to tell you go and make a chazakah, meaning go and acquire the property. If it's in front of him, then your chazakah by definition is an acquisition of the property because you're doing it in front of him. Doing it in front of him without his rejecting your action is a show of acquisition. But when you're not in front of him, the fact that you do something is not a clear indication of your acquisition. So the way to compensate for that is that he has to tell you, Lech Chazek Uknei. He tells you to go do it, and then you do it, then it's clear that you're making an acquisition on the property because he directed you to do that. So Tosfot says, that's just what you don't need over here. Over here, even Shelo Bifanav, you don't need to have a Lech Chazek Uknei. That when you walk the property, it's as if you walked in front of them, even though you didn't say Lech Chazek Uknei. That's Rav Ashi's Chiddush over here, is that you don't need either party to be present, and you can do it in this substandard form. So now there are others who bring answers. The Ramban notes that maybe there is no Chiddush in Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi is just telling us, you need a Chazaka like any time you buy Karka. The Rashbu suggests over here that the unique aspect here is the weakness of the chazakah. There are different types of chazakot that you can have. Some of them are stronger than others. And over here, the Rishonim suggest that only one of the two parties needs to make a chazakah for this to work. So the Rashba differentiates by the nature of the chazakah. If the chazakah is a strong form of chazakah, then you only need one of the two parties to act, and it forces both parties to be committed. On the other hand, if you use a weaker form of chazakah, then both parties need to exercise that. And that's what Rav Ashi is telling us over here. Zeolech betok shelo, bezeolech betok shelo. Each one of them walks in their property. That's a weaker form of chazakah. I mean that if you do some physical work, now gador paratz, you do something like that, then you're dealing with a serious type of chazakah. One of the two does it, it's sufficient. But over here, where they're using walking the perimeter or walking the property, that's a weaker form of chazakah. Therefore, you need both of them to do it. And that's what Rav Ashi's Chiddush was. Each party needs to walk their property in order to be a kinyan. So you have different views within the Rishonim as to what the Chiddush is in Rav Ashi over here. So you have the Balei Tosafot say that you don't need Lech Chazek Uknei. You have the Ramban who suggests that there is no Chiddush. It just means make a chazakah like you would did in property. You have the Rashba who speaks about that only one of the two parties needs to make a chazakah, and then you have the Agod Mamonio who qualifies that and says it depends on the nature of the kinyan as to whether you need both of them to do it or only one of them to do it. Now, Makom Shenagulev note. Now we're moving on in the Mishnah, Kvil. Now the Gemara is going through what we already discussed in the Mishnah. What are the materials that are mentioned in the Mishnah? So the first item was mentioned was Kvil. Avnei de lo Meshafya. These are stones that were quarried out, but not shaped. They were not cut or chiseled into shapes. Gazit, avnei de mishafyo. And the gazit were stones that were quarried, hewn. They were cut to shape. They are square, and they can sit on each other. Dichtiv. How do I know that? Because the pasuk Yemalachim Aleph with regards to the binyan Beit Mikdash kol el avanim yekarot kimidot gazit, and truly the pasuk ends that they are migararot to be magera, so that they were worked over with the tools. There means cut with the saws, but it obviously means with chisels, that they had used metal to shape the stones. So you see that the gazit is related to metal working tools that shape the stone. Kfisin. What about kfisin? As we mentioned in the Mishnah, arche. Those are half bricks. Levenim, livne. Levenim are full bricks. Amalei rabba brei derova, the ravashi. Mimai digvil avne delo mishafya ninhu. How do you know that gvil is really these uncut stones? V'hai tefach yetera. And the extra tefach in our Mishnah, each subsequent material requires one less tefach. So we start with 6 tefachim, then 5, 4, and 3. So the avne delo mishafya, the gvil, required 6 tefachim. Whereas the avne gazit required 5 tefachim. So that extra tefach, what is it for? The morsha der karnata. How do you, that's what we thought. It was for the corners or the sharp edges, the irregularities of these stones. Dilma, let us say, palga de gozidhu. Let us say that it's half of a hewn cut stone. By tefach yetera le bene urbehu. And that the tefach in between is for the filler material between them. If you remember yesterday, I explained that the bricks are 3 tefachim. And then you take a half brick, you have 1.5 and 1.5, and then use a tefach with a filler between them, that's how you get to the 4 tefachim. So they're suggesting, why don't you apply the same thing to the first two materials in the Mishnah? Gazit, we know, is a hewn stone, it's a fully cut stone. Now, gvil, we're saying, oh, is just an irregular, a stone that was quarried but never shaped, and you need the extra tefach because of those irregularities. Why don't we say this? It's an even gazit that they cut in half. Now they put half of it on one side, half of it on the other side, and then they fill it in the middle with the tefach in between. Why can't you say the same thing you say by Ariche, say that by Gevil? Because the Gamrinan, just like we say in the latter part of the materials, Kfisin Ariche, that the Kfisim are half bricks, Levenim Livne, and the Levenim are bricks, by Tefach Yitera. And why is there one extra Tefach by the half bricks? The Beni Urbe, for the filler material. Amalei, Uletamech, Kfisin Arche Minolan. How do you know that Kfisin are half bricks? Where do you know that from? Ella Gemara Gemirala. That's the Mesorah. The Mesorah is that these Kfisin in the Mishnah are half bricks. Gvil, Nami, Avdino Shafya, Gemara Gemirala. The same way that you know the information about the Kfisin. That's how we know about the Gvil, that the Mesorah is that Gvil is stones that weren't cut. That these are stones that were just taken out of the quarry without cutting them. Ikadamre. Some say that the question was just in the opposite direction, which is he's starting with the latter half of the Mishnah and then questioning that based on the first half of the Mishnah. Amalei Ravacha, braid the Rav Avio, the Rav Ashi, mimai dai kvisin arche ninu. How do you know these kvisin are half bricks? By tefach yitera lebeni urbe. And the extra tefach between the full bricks and the half bricks is the filler material in between. Dilma, my kvisin, avne delo meshafyan. The gears here probably shouldn't be avne delo meshafyan. You can see in Rashi, he has a gears of levene delo meshafyan. It makes more sense. These are bricks that are not cut. So these are bricks that are not shaped properly, therefore they have edges to them, and they have pieces that stick out. And then, vay tefach yitera, the mershad de karnotok, and the extra tefach you need for the bricks, the kvisin, is because they are uncut bricks, versus the levenim, which are cut or shaped bricks. And that's why you need the extra tefach, kidam rinan, similar to the way that we say it in the ratio of the Mishnah. Gvil is avne de lo mishafyan. Gazit, avne de mishafyan. Gvil are those unshaped stones, whereas the gazit are the shaped stones. By tefach yitera, and the extra tefach in the resha is the moshar de karnata for the points, for the irregularities in the stones. Amalei ulutameich, gvil, avnei delam b'shafion minolan. How do you know that gvil is a stone that is not cut? Ela gemara gemirala. That's a mesorah. That's the only reason you know it there. Hachanami, so too, by kfisin, nami gemara gemirala. That's also the mesorah that they are half bricks and not irregular bricks. Amar Abaye, Shvamina, from our Mishnah you would conclude, kobene urbe tefach, that the space between the two rows of the bricks is a tefach. Now, why does that make a difference? Usually when the Gemara says something like this, it's for mekach u'memkar. That means that if someone commits to build a wall in a certain fashion, these are the measurements that we're expecting. If you sell somebody a wall that is supposedly built in this manner, these are the measurements we would expect for it to be a good wall. Zahani mile betina. That's only true if they put plaster between the two rows of half bricks. Aval berichsa boitfe. But if they put the filler as plaster and small stones in there, more like a cement-like type of mix, then you need more space between them. Vigadamre, some say the other way around. Hane mile berichsa. That our Mishnah, when it says a tefach, that's when you put in the plaster and the small stones and the other filler material. Aval betina, when you're just using the plaster, loba ikule hai, then you don't need a full tefach, you can use even less. So now the Gemara says, a memra. From our Mishnah, you would conclude, dibigazit. When you're talking about these hewn stones, these shaped and cut stones, to call dolet amot gova, that when you go to 4 amot of height, iavi putya, if the width of the base is chamisha, 5 tfachim, koi, it's structurally sound. Ilo, lo koi. But if it's not, it will not stand. Our Mishnah requires a base of 5 tfachim. When you use avnei gazit, it said each party has to contribute 2.5 tfachim for a base of 5 tfachim. 4 amot is the minimum height of a wall that prevents hezek riyah. And based on the conclusion of our Gemara, that the Mishnah is talking about ratzu means they decided to split it. Once they decided to split it, you must build a wall because there is hezek riyah. Once there is hezek riyah, the way to solve the problems of hezek riyah, we'll see that in the upcoming Mishnayot, is a wall of 4 amot high. That's the minimum standard of wall. So now, if I'm telling you that you got to build a wall of 4 amot high, and I'm only demanding a base of 5 tfachim, that's telling me that a structurally sound wall requires 5 tfachim base for 4 amot of height. V'ha amatraksin. Davi gvoa tlatin amhata. What are you going to do with the Beit HaMikdash? In the Beit HaMikdash, the amatraksin is the space between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim. In the first Beit HaMikdash, the space between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim was a wall. A wall with a doorway through the middle. We'll see in a second, but we know that in the second Beit HaMikdash, they used parochot instead of wall there. And the Gemara will ask why. That's part of this discussion. But the wall was there with a door through the middle to go between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim. That wall was an amah thick at the base. An amah is 6 tfachim. It means that you have a base of 6 tfachim, and the height of the wall, we know the height of the heichal was 30 amot. So that means that you have a 6 tfachim base that is holding up 30 amot of height. Meantime, our Mishnah is demanding 5 tfachim for 4 amot of height. V'lo avi puchi ala shit pushchei. There are only 6 tfachim wide, v'kam, and it stood up. It says, given to Ika tefach yiteira koi. Says, that's it. You're right. Eino chanami. The extra tefach gives you a lot more. It's not a ratio. Doesn't mean that for every 4 amot, you need 5 tfachim in width in the base. That means, oh, you want to go 8 amot, you need 10 tfachim? No. The 5 tfachim are the sound structure. If you want to go higher, you just need to incrementally add a small amount. So to go from 4 amot to 30 amot, you only need to add a tefach. You don't need to double, triple the base. You simply need to expand it a little bit. That's what the Gemara suggests. The Gemara, Amud Bet, is going to give an alternate answer, which it could have given over here, and that Tosafot points out already, that it could have just said there was a ceiling there, which makes a huge difference. And that's because you have pressure from the top that holds it in place. So it's different to talk about a wall that's freestanding versus a wall that has something on top of it giving it pressure, and therefore it could be the answer here is that you had pressure from the top, which the Gemara will discuss in, which makes a big difference. Now in terms of Amatraksin, here the Rabbeinu Tam, we've seen this in the Bali Tosafot before, talks about the source for the Traksin that is over here. He says, Omer Rabbeinu Tam, the Trak have kemo Truke Gali Bebrachot, the Sin have Sinai. Kolomer hayu mafsik v'sugeret aluchot. That's what traksin means. Traksin means to block and to stop your ability to get to the luchot, that which came from Sinai, that were placed in the Aron. V'yesh mefarshim shetraksin panim v'chutz. Some say that it means in and out. Sh'oto amah haya safek. They didn't know what to do with that amah, whether it belongs to the Kodesh or the Kodesh of Kodeshim. While there's a wall there, it doesn't matter because nobody's stepping over there. But once they go to the Bayit Sheni, and they don't have a wall, they're going to put up a parochet, they don't know which side of that amah to put the parochet on, so traksin means something that is in or out at the same time. And there's doubt about which side it belongs to. Where it says, u'b'mikdash sheni, my time lo avud amah traksin. The second Beit HaMikdash, why didn't they put together an amah traksin? Ki koi, bitlatin koi. When you have a wall that is 6 tefachim wide, it can hold up a 30 amah wall, 30 amah high wall. Tvei lokai. Higher than that, it can't do it. Uminala and Avi Gvoa Tvei. How do you know that in the second Beit HaMikdash, the height of the Eichal exceeded the height of the first Beit HaMikdash? Because the Pasuk says, Godol yeh kvod ha-bayit hazeh acharon min harishon. It says in Haggai that the honor, the glory of the second Beit HaMikdash will be greater than the Rishon. Acharon doesn't mean the last, but means not the Rishon. They have that by Pashat Vayishlach. By Pashat Vayishlach, when Yaakov meets his brother Esav, it uses the word Acharon in describing when Leah and her children go before Esav. And then it uses the word Acharon again when it talks about Rachel and her child Yosef going before Esav. So you see over there, Acharon can't be the last because there's another Acharon after it. Acharon just means the one after the Rishonim. And it means the next one. So here, the second bayit, the next bayit will be greater in glory than the first bayit. Rabbi Shmuel argued about what that means. Some say it's a machlok between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar. Amar b'binyan, the physical structure was greater. Amar b'shanim, and one of them says by the years, the duration of the Mikdash was longer than the first Beit HaMikdash. And both of them are true, meaning that the second Beit HaMikdash, in terms of scale, was much larger than the first Beit HaMikdash, as well as the fact that, based on the Gemara and Yoma, that the Chachamim thought that the second Beit HaMikdash stood for 420 years, whereas the first Beit HaMikdash stood for 410 years. Most secular historians believe that the second Beit HaMikdash stood for 586 years, as the first one stood for 410 years. So then there is a significant time difference between the first and second Beit HaMikdash. But either way, they are both true. Now, in terms of the change in structure, the change in structure was only in terms of height. If the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim had to have the same blueprint or layout that they had in the Bayit HaRishon. So we're talking about the length and width of the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim, those remained the same. The only thing that changed in the Eichal was the height of the Eichal was significantly higher. So now you're running yourself into a problem, which is that if you're not scaling the width and the length of it, but you are scaling up the height, then how do you deal with the Amatrak sin? Because otherwise, you could have just widened the Amatrak skin on a scale basis. Which is, well, if you're going to make it longer, on a relative basis, just make the Amatrak sin wider, and then you would compensate for the height. But they're not doing that because they're leaving the blueprint or the footprint intact, but they are raising the height of the Heichal. So in doing so, they ran into a problem. V'navdu tzlatin amin b'binyan. The Gemara says, okay, so why don't you build the first 30 amot in height of a wall, and then use a parochet for anything that exceeded that amount. The Gemara says, Kikoi tzlatin amhata, nami agav tikro umaziva havakoi. As we mentioned before, that the Gemara is going to give this answer, that 30 amot only worked both because it had a base of 6 tvachim, but also because it had pressure from the top to hold it in place. Below tikra maziba lo vakoi. If you have a freestanding wall that's 30 amot high, sitting on a base of 6 tefachim, that would not be structurally sound. So the truth is, how high is the heichal? In the second Beit HaMikdash, the Mishnayot and Midot say that it's 100 amot high. But the truth is that it was 100 amot high with the Aliyah. There was a second level to the Kodesh HaKodeshim. The actual Kodesh HaKodeshim and the Kodesh in the heichal were 40 amot high. So it's still in excess of the 30 amot, but it's not 100 amot where it's significantly in excess. But there is a division that's made both upstairs in the Aliyah and downstairs below. They had curtains that divided between them. So Gemara says, V'lavid ma de'efsher b'binyan. So build a wall as high as you can that is structurally sound. V'lavid idach parochet. And then make the remainder on top of that a curtain. Amar Abaye gmiri. We have a misora, maybe even a loch l'moshe misinai. Ikulu bibinyan, ikulu biparochet. Either the division has to be a full-fledged wall, or it has to be a full-fledged parochet. You can't mix and match. Ikulu bibinyan, mimikdash. How do I know that you can have a wall there? From the mikdash rishon. Ikulu biparochet, how do I know that? Mimishkan, from the mishkan of midbar. So we know that either one works, but we don't have the ability to mix and match them. Now, the reason the Gemara is pushing towards putting up a wall is to avoid the problem. The problem is that you have an Amma that sits between the Kodesh and Kodesh Kodeshim. If you put a wall on that Amma, then you don't have to decide whether it belongs to the Kodesh or the Kodesh Kodeshim because it's taken up by the footprint of the wall. When you hang a parochet, then you're in a much different situation. A parochet is not so wide, and it's not going to encompass the whole amatrix scene. Now you have a problem. Do you hang the curtain from the front piece of the amatrix scene or the back of the amatrix scene? We don't know, and that's what ends up happening is they put up two curtains. And that's what is described in Mishnayot and Midot, that they had a curtain on the one side of the amatrix scene and a curtain on the other side of the amatrix scene with a door to enter on the right and then a door to enter on the left as you went through. And that's what's described in the Avodat Yom HaKippurim of the Kohen Gadol, that he used to enter and walk between the parochot and then enter into the Kodesh HaKodeshim. That's all caused by this problem of the inability to build a wall that would reach the height of the Heichal, again, because you've left the footprint intact, but raised the height of the Heichal. So now, the Gemara says, Ibailuhu, Hein v'sidan, Odama Hein below sidan. It's actually, in Israel, you can see this. In places or countries where they work with wood and plasterboard, it's harder to really see this. But in Israel, where they pour the houses from cement or cinder block, once they've done that, you have to actually put a white plaster or cover on the walls. So whenever they build here, you see them pour the cement wall. Then on top of that, to smooth out the edges and to create a finish to it, they put a tiach, this plaster, on the cement, that white plaster. The question that's being asked here by the Gemara is, the measurements in our Mishnah, they're talking about the width of the wall. Are they the width of the wall, and then afterwards you add on the tiach, you add on the plaster on top of it? Or do they include the plaster in those numbers? So the Gemara says, "Amar Nachum Yitzchak Mistavra Hein V'Sidan." Makes sense that the measurements in the Mishnah are giving you when it says 6 tefachim in width, 5 tefachim in width. That is the materials plus the plaster. That means that the materials themselves would take up a little less than the full amount. If you say that it's the measure of the width of the materials without the plaster, litnei the shiurei, then tell us how much you need to leave or give for the plastering on top. Elalav shmina, so that you would conclude, hein visidan, that the measurement in the Mishnah is giving you the total width of the wall inclusive of the plaster. It says, lo, olam emelachayin below sidan. The Mishnah is talking about just the materials without the plaster. V'kevin delavi tefach lo tani. It doesn't reach a significant amount. The plaster is a very thin layer that goes on top. And again, if you go again to Herodian ruins in Israel, so if you go up to Masada, you can see it, and other places like that, where they used smaller stones, and in order to simulate the being marble or larger stones, they put plaster on top, and then carved in edges to it so it looked like they were massive stones, even though the plaster was covering smaller stones that were used to build it. If you go to Masada, you can see the lines of the plaster. They mark them for you there, and you can see the plaster on top of the stones. So that's exactly what is being described over here. So the Gemara says that that plaster is very thin. So then, the Mishnah telling you about the whole measurements, the whole tefachim that you have to give up. It's not about that little amount of plaster that you can have on afterwards. Gemara says, does it, the Mishnah only give you full tefachim? Vaktani, it says by Levenim, Zed notain tefach umechza, vezed notain tefach umechza. Rashi has a different girsa. You can say, Vaktani tefachim umechza. He's just talking about the gazit instead of the Levenim. But whichever way, we went from them contributing 3 and 3, then to 2.5 and 2.5. So we see that they do use half tefachim in the measurements that are there. It says, Atam chazidetz terufe. I mean, there they add up to a whole tefach. You're splitting it 2.5 and 2.5, but that adds up to a full tefach. So that's why they mentioned it. We're not going to mention a tenth of a tefach, that is the plaster that you have to add on. And so therefore, the measurements here could have been without the plaster on them. So it's not conclusive from the Mishnah, Tashma. So let us try to learn it from here, from a Mishnah in Erevin. Korah Shamru, Rachva Kedele Kabela Ariach. Now, a Korah that you put at the end of a Mavoy. The end of the Mavoy, when you have a Mavoy She'enu Mifulash, that's a Mavoy that has three walls around it with Chatzerot open up to it, and the fourth side opens up to the Reshut Rabim. In order to be able to carry in that Mavoy, you need two things. You need Shituf Mivot, which is all the parties joined together into a single, quote-unquote, meal that they bring together, wine and other items that they can join together with, and they have to demarcate the end of the mavoy. That can be either done by a lechi or a korah. The lechis are the ones stand by the sides of the doors, and the korah goes over the top. That korah that you put over the top, what is the minimum size of that korah? It has to be a korah that is kedela kabel ariach, that has the ability to hold a ariach, v'ariach chatzi levena, and the ariach is half a brick, shel gimel tfachim. It's a half brick of a full brick that is 3 tfachim. There we're not talking about plastering. Over there we're talking about the dimensions of the korah. So it has nothing to do with plaster. This is not going to be a finished brick. You're not going to put a brick up there. This is just a way to determine how big the korah is, the width of the korah, not to tell you what the wall is going to look like. Therefore, it's clearly speaking without plaster. If it's speaking about without plaster, that means that a brick is 3 tefachim. That means when our Mishnah says 3 tefachim, it literally means 3 tefachim. Where it says, hotam biravrita. Now those are the big bricks. Tekanami, I can prove that to you. Diktani, shel shloshat tefachim. That it says there that this is a half brick when bricks are 3 tefachim. Well, why is it telling you that the bricks are 3 tefachim? Standard bricks are all 3 tefachim. It must mean that these are the bigger bricks. Miklau, the ikazutra. That shows you that there are less bricks that are less size than that. Shema minas. From this you would conclude that our Mishnah includes the plaster because the bricks that are mentioned over there are bricks of 3 tefachim, but those are 3 tefachim because they are the larger bricks. Tosfot over here, it says, how do you know that? It could be that there are bigger bricks. Why are you so sure that they're smaller bricks? All it's telling you is that when you measure the half bricks here, use a whole brick that is 3 tefachim. When it defines to you what the size of a brick is, that means that there are different size bricks. Different sizes could be bigger, or they could be smaller. So then why do you automatically assume that these are the big bricks? And now we're talking about smaller bricks. The Rishonim answer, if this was the smallest size, then if it gave no measurement in the Mishnah, we're dealing with a din derabanan, and if the Mishnah gives you no definition, then we're going to assume the smallest size. So if 3 tefachim was the smallest size, it wouldn't be necessary to tell us that size. The fact that it told us the size already tells you that that's not the smallest size, because otherwise it would not have to define the size for you. The fact that it does define the size already means that there must be something smaller than that. Something smaller than that, that's what our Mishnah is dealing with. A brick that is less than 3 tefachim, and that less than 3 tefachim has the plaster on it, and that's why it adds up to the 3 tefachim in our Mishnah. Over here, we have a move to a new sugya completely. Nothing to do with our Mishnah, nothing to do with our Perek. The reason that the Gemara seems to be moving over to here is because we mentioned the second Beit HaMikdash. And so in mentioning the second Beit HaMikdash, the Gemara here is going to explicate on how it was that the second Beit HaMikdash was greater than the first Beit HaMikdash, because that wasn't true at the outset. When Ezra and Nehemiah come back and build the Beit HaMikdash, the situation of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael as well as in Yerushalayim was pretty precarious. And they did what they could and they built a nice Mikdash, but it wasn't so mifu'ar, it wasn't so beautiful, it wasn't so glorious. And we know that with regards to the Kelim as well, that they had to slowly build the Kelim as they became wealthier. They upgraded the Kelim and they moved through different metals until they got to gold. And we talk about the glory of the second Beit HaMikdash was after the renovations that were done by Herod. Herod did renovations on the Beit HaMikdash. That's what we see today as Har HaBayit. It's no longer a har anymore. It's no longer a mountain. If you go on the tunnel tours and you follow down, they show you the bedrock of the mountain, the actual bedrock of the mountain. Or if you come from the northern side of the Har HaBayit, you can also see the bedrock there because on the northern side, you're pretty level with Har HaBayit. So there you can see the bedrock or the level of the actual mountain. What Herod did, and that's what you see today, was build retaining walls around them. The Kotel, the western wall, is a retaining wall. And then he filled those retaining walls to create a plateau on top, to create a flat plain upon which he built the Beit HaMikdash. Most of the filler is to the southern side, which is why the Beit HaMikdash, if you look where the Dome of the Rock is today, or all the models, you see it's skewed to the northwestern side, because most of the addition of the filler in the mountain went to the southern side. That's also why the Mishnayot described that there were tunnels under the Mikdash, because when you're dealing with bedrock, you're not going to be speaking about tunnels. When you speak about filler, then you can talk about tunnels, as well as the Alaskar Mosque, which is skewed to the southern side of the plateau. That mosque is mostly underground, below the level of the plateau up top. And that's also when you go to the southern side, when you see the gates are below ground, and they go up as you climb up. There were stairs that allowed you to enter, come up into the flat area on top. So all this was done by Herod. And then Herod, when he renovated the Mikdash, made it into this glorious building. And it was well invested because here you had the Roman Empire basically paying for the Beit HaMikdash. Because Herod was the king or vassal of Rome at the time, and he uses taxation as well as a lot of slave labor, including probably some many Jews in slave labor, to build the Beit HaMikdash. I mean, that's always where they have questions about how they got some of those stones there. They're so big. But I guess when you have disposable human beings, that you can always get anything there in the end. But that's all Herodian. So the Gemara here wants to discuss how it came about that Herod actually renovated the Beit HaMikdash. In order to do that, we have this introductory part that gets us into this, which is Amrav Chista. Lolistor inish beiknishta, o the boni beiknishta achrite. One may not take down a Beit HaKnesset in the city until you build a new Beit HaKnesset. So if you want to build a new Beit HaKnesset, you want to renovate the Beit HaKnesset, you need to build a new one and then only afterwards take down the old one. Ikadamre, there are two reasons given for this. One is Mishum Pshiuta, that we're worried about people being Pusheya. In the end, not building the other one. Either not raising sufficient funds, or if they raise the sufficient funds, not actually going through with it or finishing it in a timely manner. Ikadamre, Mishum Tzluye. Others say it's a problem of where do they daven in the interim. So where do they daven in the interim if you take down the Beit HaKnesset? My benayu. What is the nafkamina between these two reasons? Ike benayu. Deika. Here there are two girsaot in the Gemara. It actually has major nafkamina to halacha, which is deika Beit HaKnesset achrita. Some say that if there's another shul in town, then that's okay because then there's a place to daven. The other or the alternate girsa you can see in the Masorah de Shas, and the Gemara is Masorah Duchta Litzuye, if they have a place to daven. So that means they have a place to daven, even though it's not a Beit Knesset. That's a nafkamina between whether the reasoning here is because we're afraid you're not going to build the other one, or whether you have an alternate place to daven. If it's about having an alternate place to daven, if you do have an alternate place to daven, then it won't be an issue. You can take down the Beit Knesset and then put up the new Beit Knesset. We don't worry about it. On the other hand, if you believe that's a problem that we are afraid you'll never follow through and finish the Beit Knesset because they find a new place to daven, they're happy, and then they never put up the new Beit HaKnesset. Then you've taken down the old one and not put up a new one. What's the problem with that? I heard from my Rebbe Reb Rosenzweig that he spoke about the profile of a city. When you talk about a profile of a city, the Mishnayot also tell us about what is the minimum number of people that need to be in a city for it to have a Beit Din. What does a city look like? What type of professions does a normal city have? And even in the modern day, when you talk about a city, you're looking for certain services that you would expect a city to have. And that the profile of a city is determined by the services or the conveniences that it has. So for instance, a city with a number of supermarkets is a city that has a higher profile because then you have choice opportunities to go by. A location with just a makolet in it is a place that doesn't have as high a profile because you're limited in your ability to shop in that local area, unless there are supermarkets nearby. So the profile of any given area or any given city is determined by the structures and the facilities that are available. And that means that when you have a city that has shuls in it, the number of shuls does make a difference. The number of batei knesiot and batei midrashot that are in a city give a certain profile of kedusha or a profile to the city. So now, the problem that we have here is, if you take down a Beit Knesset, even though there might be other places to daven, even though there might be other alternatives, the Manda Amar who says that it's Mishum Pshiuta says, no, that's not good enough because you've now reduced the profile of the city in terms of Kedusha. You've removed one of those Batei Knesiot from the location. And therefore, that's why he emphasizes the idea that we don't want to allow for there to be one less shul in this city, because having less shuls in the city changes the dynamic of the city, the profile of the city, and even in a sense, the profile of the Kedusha of the city. So now, the Gemara says, based on that, Mrei Mar Marzutra, Satre Ubanu, Bekaita Besitva, Ubeitsitva Bekaita, that they used to take down the summer shul during the winter, and the winter shul during the summer. They had two shuls. Rashi over here describes the difference between the two shuls, which is that in the winter time they had thicker walls, lower ceiling with less windows to keep it warm inside. In the summertime they had higher walls, more windows to give more air and to allow for more flow during the summertime. So they had these different shuls. And so what they did was, on the off season, they took down that shul. Because there they don't have a problem. First of all, they have the other shul that they're davening in. Number one. Number two is that when they take it down, they are unlikely not to put it back up because of the difference of the nature in the shul. Because they're not going to want to daven in the winter shul when it comes to the summer because of the inconvenience. So they did this on the off season in order not to have that problem. Amalei Rabbeinu Ravashi, Gavu Zuzei Umachtei Mai. What happens if they already collected, they put in the building fund, they collected the money to build a new building, and now they want to take down the old building. Is that allowed? They already have all the funds collected. Amalei, Dilma Mitrami Lahu Pijon Shvuyim, V'yavu Lahu. You have a risk that even when you have the money, that a big mitzvah, the reason they pick Pidyon Shavuim is because Pidyon Shavuim supersedes Beit Knesset, it supersedes anything, and it's something where you need money quickly. So here they're going to take those funds and expend it on Pidyon Shavuim, and all of a sudden you don't have the new shul. So the Gemara says, Frigat Livnei v'Hadrei Hadurei u'machtei Kishurei Mai. What happens if they bring in the pallets of bricks, and they bring in the roof tiles, and they bring in the boards, the floorboards or the ceiling beams. And they've got all the materials. They purchased the materials. And now they want to do this. Because sometimes even when you have all the materials paid for, it's all sitting there. They're going to sell the materials and then use the monies for Pidyon Shvuyim. He says, once you say that, even when they build the shul, they could sell the shul and do Pidyon Shvuyim. Tosfos notes that over here, when the Gemara asked about selling the shul for Pidyon Shvuyim, he says that's only Achi Paluba. It's only once they haven't davened in it. Because Hazman Alav Milti, the designation of it as a shul is not enough. Once they daven in it, then it gives it a status of a shul, and then they can't sell the shul for Pidyon Shvuyim. There are Rishonim that disagree with the Balei Tosfos and say even once they've davened in it, they could sell the shul to raise funds for Pidyon Shvuyim. And the Gemara's question relates to even to a shul that's already been utilized. People don't sell their house. Now, that's literal. People, when they have a house, they don't sell their house. They need somewhere else to live. So they're not going to sell their house unless they have another place to live. The guards to a shul, it's the same thing. Once you have a shul, they don't sell the shul because then they won't have anything left. So then they're not going to sell it. In the case where they just have materials here and they're already accommodating whatever it is in the interim, we're afraid that they're going to sell those items in order to do Pidyon Shvuyim, and then we won't have what we need to build a new building. Below Amran, El Delo Chazi Batiyua. It's only true if there isn't any structural damage to the shul. Of a Chazi Batiyua, Satri Ubani. If there is structural damage, you take it down and you build it, because then there's a danger to the people of it collapsing, and we're not going to allow that. I mean, that we don't keep it up just for that reason. So they had this problem. There were structural problems or damage in this shul in Matamaxia. Satre. They took it down before they put up the new shul. But in order to make sure that that wasn't a problem, he moved his bed into where they were building the shul. And he didn't move out until they put the gutters on the new shul. So he made sure to inconvenience himself to the point where there would be no delay in building the shul, which is that he moved himself in to where they were building the shul. And that meant as long as the shul wasn't complete, he was living outdoors, he was camping, he was exposed to the elements. So in order to prevent any delay, he put himself into a position of inconvenience until they finished the shul. And by there, he was permitted to do this anyway, to take it down, because there was a structural damage. But in order to make sure that they weren't lazy about it and they moved along, he put himself in the area of the shul. Now, this goes back. Tosfot over here addresses two issues. First of all, with regards to the summer and winter shuls, why is it that they're allowed to take down the off-season shul? If there are two separate shuls, we already said it doesn't matter how many shuls there are, according to the one who says it's because of pshiuta, and therefore over here too, why should it matter that it's the off-season? So Tosfot over here says that it must be k'mon de'ika tiyua, that there was some structural damage, vishari, and that's why it was mutar, to take down the off-season shul. Vo'nira, the other possibility is k'evin she'esham beit knesset acher, ein lachush im lo yivne zot. On the other hand, maybe the possibility is because there's another shul there, we don't worry about in the end if they don't build this shul. And therefore, Tosfot then has to read the Gemara when it says there's no other place to daven, means that there's no other Beit Knesset in town. So now, Tosfot over here is suggesting against what we mentioned before, which is that as long as there's one shul in town, you're set. But the number of shuls isn't as important, according to this answer, Tosfot. And then he gets a third answer, which is, V'od machmad kor v'chom ein lachush, shem yivashu o bezman gadol kolkach ein lachush. Says, when it comes to seasons, where it makes a big difference whether you're in the summer shul or the winter shul, people don't have pshuta. Or when you have a large time period like that in the off season, there isn't pshuta. So Tosfot gives three answers as to why they were allowed to do it on the off season. Two of which are fundamental, which is either that when it comes to shuls that are designated for a particular season, they're not going to be lazy about making sure that they get the other shul in place for this season. Or when there's another shul in town, we don't worry about you taking this one down, even if you don't rebuild it. And then the other one, which was the technical problem, was that there was structural damage, like we saw here, which is a dispensation to take down the shul, no matter what. The last thing that Tosfot addresses over here, which actually has major nafka mina da halacha, is why was it permissible for Rav Ashi to move his bed into this shul? Betema, how is that possible? One of the rules of a batei kenesiot is that you're not allowed to sleep there. Lo yishanim bam lo shinat keva velo shinat arai. In a shul, you may not sleep there, not a full-fledged sleep, or neither a nap. You can't take those in a shul. And then he goes on to say that the Gemara in Megillah says that the batei kenesiot b'Babel were built al tnai. They were built on condition, which gave permission for you to utilize them for things besides just being a shul. The Rashi over there says that that changes all the rules of the batei knesiot. And even though the rules of a batei knesiot are you can't eat in there, you can't drink in there, you can't escape from the rain into the shul or escape from the heat into the shul, you can't utilize it for your own personal benefit. The Tnai in Bavel, it says that the batei knesiot and Bavel were built on condition to allow these items. That's how Rashi explains it, to allow all these items that are otherwise prohibited in a shul. Then the Baal Tosfot show that that's not the case. They bring examples of why that may not be the case. And therefore, they say that the Tnai in Bavel is only helpful for the fact that if you take down the shul in the end, that you have a right to sell the property or use the area of the shul for any purpose except a purpose of Gnai, something that would be a denigration to the shul if you made it into an outhouse afterwards, or you did something that made it into a stable. You did something that would have been inappropriate for the shul. But if you change it to anything else, it's permitted because the batei knesiot and bavel were built out tnai that they have a right to sell them in the end and to remove the kedusha from them in the end. So it does what it says. That's all it does. It does not give you permission to sleep in there, eat in there, or do anything else. And therefore, he's now back in a bind as to what you're going to do with Rav Ashi sleeping in the batei knesiot. So he actually invokes the Gemara that's in the end of Psachim, in Arvei Psachim, over there, the Machloket, about the question of Kiddush B'Makom Suda. And over there, Shmuel says that you make Kiddush in Shul, even though it's not Makom Suda, because it is a Makom Suda for the guests that stay in the Shul. And there, the Gemara describes that there were side rooms in the Shul where guests used to sleep and eat by the Shul. As you'll see, that within the Shul, contained within the Shul, was not just the area where they daven, but also these extra areas in which people would sleep and eat, or guest houses that were around the shul. Therefore, the Baal Tosfot suggests, similar to that Gemara in Arvei Psachim, that the place that Rav Ashi was sleeping in was that area that was designated for the guests and did not have the Kedushat Beit HaKnesset. And now this segues us into the discussion about the second Beit HaMikdash, which is Ubaba ben Buta, Eichi Asvele Eitza Lehurdus, the mystery of the Beit HaMikdash. How did Bava ben Buta give advice to Herod to take down the Beit HaMikdash in order to renovate it? Looking at the dinim that we have here, you're not allowed to take down the item until you put the new one up. And by the Beit HaMikdash, that's an irreplaceable type of area. So you have to have it functioning while you're building. So how could he give him advice to take it down before he put up the new one? So here the answers are, Ibayit Ema Tiyua Chazabei. One possibility is that they were structural flaws or damage to the Beit HaMikdash, and therefore they could take it down first. Ibayit Ema Machuta Shaini Delohajabei. The other case is that the rulers, the king, is different than lay people. Lay people, issues and incidents come up, and therefore they change their mind. The king, once he's made a decision, he stands by that decision. And therefore, there's not going to be any pshuta. So even though they took it down first, the commitment of the king to put it up is enough of a commitment that we don't worry about him backing out of that commitment. Damar Shmuel, Imar Mar Machuta Krana Ture, Akar Ture. If the government says they're going to uproot a mountain, they're going to uproot the mountain below other band. They don't back away from it. Just as a side note, I think that the Gemara here might be describing Herod himself. For those who have the chance to visit Herodion, which is the burial place of Herod as well as one of his palaces, and after much excavating in the recent past, they actually found the sarcophagus of Herod. The way that Herodion was built was actually by chopping off or cutting down a adjacent mountain in order to add on to the area of the mountain, which became Herodion, to make it the highest mountain in the area. So Herod himself actually did this. He said he's going to cut down a mountain and then put up another mountain. And he did exactly that. So I don't know if that's the Gemara playing on something that Herod himself said or did, or it's just a more general statement by Shmuel, because Shmuel's in Bavel. But this idea that if the government says they're going to take down a mountain, they do take down a mountain. And that's exactly what Herod did in the building of Herodion. So now Gemara continues with the story of Herod, which is Hurdus Avda de Beit Chashmonai Abba. He was a slave in the house of the Chashmonaim. Natan Einav Boto Tinuket. He wanted to marry one of the young girls, one of the young princesses of Beit Chashmonai. Yom Echad, one day, Shema'u Gavra Batko, Herod heard this heavenly voice saying, Tamarko Avda de Marid Hashta Matzlach. Any slave, servant that rebels today will be successful. Come, that's exactly what he did. He rebelled against his masters. Katlinu the Kulu Marute. He killed all of his masters, meaning he killed out all the Beit Chashmonai, the dynasty of the Chashmonaim, so that he would then become the de facto ruler. Vishari the Hayinukta. He left alive this one princess that he had so desired before. When that young girl, that young princess realized that Herod wanted to marry her in order to give him, in a sense, a right to the royalty, not just through killing his masters, but actually through marriage, he would then become the king. Slika the Igra, she went up to the roof. Verama Kala Amra, she raised her voice, she called out and said, anybody who says that I'm a descendant or I'm of the dynasty of the Chashmonaim, Avdahu, he is definitely a slave or a servant. Because the only remnant of the Chashmonaic dynasty is me. And that girl, me, I'm about to commit suicide. I'm jumping off the roof. And therefore, there is no remnant of the Chashmonaic dynasty. Tamna Shemeshnim Bedufsha. Herod preserved the girl after she killed herself for 7 years in honey. Honey is known as a preservative because of the high sugar content. Bacteria are unable to live in there because it kills the bacteria because the sugar content is too high. And therefore, honey is an amazing preservative. And so here, the Gemara is talking about him using honey as a preservative for this young girl. Igadamri Bala. Some say that he kept her around in order to fulfill his desires to be together with this young girl. Igdamri lo bala. Some say that, no, that he didn't keep her around in order to fulfill his desires. Damri lo bala. Ha tamno le tuve yitzre. The one who says that he did have relations with her, the reason he kept her around was to have relations with her. Damri lo bala. According to one who says he didn't have relations with her, ha tamno kohecha kihecha denemru bat melech nasav. He kept her around to make believe that he was married to her and that she was actually his wife. And so therefore he kept her around to demonstrate his right to the kingship or his right to royalty. Amar Mandorish, Mikerav Achecha Tasim Alecha Melech. Who is the one who's Doresh that the Pasuk of Mikerav Achecha, from amongst your brethren, you must appoint a king? They're Abonon. The Rabbanan Darshan Mikerav Achecha, that it has to be Me'achecha. It has to be a fellow Jew that is appointed as the king. The truth is, the Bayi Tosafot say, without the drush of Chazal, you would have assumed that Achecha doesn't literally mean a Jew or a fellow Jew. It would mean anybody who's Achecha who has a commonality with you, whether it's a commonality in mitzvot, or commonality in the fact that he's Israel. So then, if that's the case, even a ger, or even an eved, could become the king, because they have a commonality, or a common denominator with you, in the sharing of mitzvot. A ger is full-fledged chayav in mitzvot, and an eved kanani is chayav in mitzvot ki'isha. So they do have a semblance of Achecha. So had you not had the drush of Chazal, that would have permitted both Herod to be the king, as well as Agrippas, his descendants, to be the kings, because they came from being an Eved, and they have the din of Achecha. The drush of Chazal on the word Achecha, which means b'miyuchad should be Achecha, from the finest amongst you, which causes the preclusion of an Eved as well as a Ger from taking up the position of king, that's what caused Herod a problem, that the Chachamim would not recognize him as a true inheritor to the crown. So he says, well, the Rabbanan are causing me a problem because of their drusha of the Psukim. Kam katlinu l'kulu Rabbanan. He killed all of the Rabbanan, b'shavkei, the Baba ben Buta, the Mishkal Eitzaminei. But he kept Baba ben Buta alive in order to take advice, to take counsel from him. Others suggest that Baba ben Buta was left alive because he was a Talmid Muvhak of Shammai. And Shammai, at some point in the Midrash, had some sort of nivuah or predicted to Herod that Herod would become the king. And therefore, Herod was favorably disposed towards Shammai, or Shammai's Talmid Muvhak, Baba ben Buta. And maybe that's why he left Baba ben Buta alive. As the Baal Tosafot point out over here, it can't be that he just left Baba ben Buta alive, because we find other Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael. Like when Hillel comes from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, he finds the family of the Nesim of Bnei B'Teira. And that's around the time that Herod comes to power. The Bnei B'Teira are the Nesim in Eretz Yisrael. So it can't be that he killed all the Chachamim out. He must have killed out a significant number of the Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael, but not wiping them out entirely. But Baba ben Buta, who was a very central figure, he's one of the highest halakhic authorities, but also well-renowned for his humility as well as his tzidkut. And therefore, he was a person of tremendous stature. So maybe within those of tremendous stature, Baba ben Buta was the only one that Herod left alive in order to take counsel from him. That's what over here discusses a Gemara in Sotah about Agrippas HaMelech, a descendant of Herod, most likely Agrippas II, who was the king at the time of the Churban HaBayit. And over there, Agrippas HaMelech is distraught over the fact that he is not really a king under Jewish law because of the problem of Kerev Achecha. And the Chachamim over there, flattering him in some sense, say, Achinu ata, you are our brother. Rashi over there claims that you are a brother because his mother was Jewish, even though he was a descendant of Herod. Tosfot is bothered by that because if his mother was Jewish, then he would be a full-fledged Israel, and then there would be no problem of him being the king. And so therefore, Tosfot says, when the Chachamim over there said, Achinu ata, that you really are brother, that Achinu ata, meaning that you qualify as Achecha, was because he was from Herod, who was an Eved, and you are Achicha b'mitzvot. You are our brother in mitzvot. And the Gemara relates over there that the Chachamim were punished for the fact that they called him Achinu Ata, because he really wasn't. They were just flattering him in a almost self-serving manner, and the Gemara says that they were punished for that because they didn't speak the truth, and that they were just trying to flatter him and to say things that were actually incorrect. And he wasn't Achecha, and he shouldn't have been the king. But nevertheless, they claimed that he was Achecha, according to Rashi, because his mother was Jewish. Tosafot rejects that, because then he would have been a full-fledged Achecha. But rather, he says he was called Achecha, because Achecha b'mitzvot, which leads Tosafot to the Havamina of what would have been the interpretation of the Pasuk over here of Achecha, means Achecha b'mitzvot, which the Chachamim dispel with their drasha b'miyuchad b'achecha. And that's what bothered Herod, and that's why he killed out the Chachamim, who were opposed to his ascension to the throne. Okay, we'll stop over here in the last line of Gimel Mudbet and continue with the story of Baba ben Buta and Herod on tomorrow's daf.